Collected dates with my father. 1. Every night, my father bends one arm under the crook behind my knees, the other around my waist, and carries my body to bed. He tucks my mermaid covers up to my chin, squeezes my feet over the sheets. Darkness is heavier when alone in it. My father moves the pads of his fingers down my nose, across my forehead, so slow and gentle, like he's offering me holy water. He calls this fingertips and tells me not to be so frightened. There's nothing that can hurt me, not as long as he lives. I close my eyes and the stories come. There once was a little girl with a flying horse. Everybody loved her. The fact that the horse could fly was a secret only the little girl knew. The girl wanted to live far, far away. Paris, maybe, or Kentucky. Somewhere with grass blue as twilight, where the wind would comb it flat and sweet. But the horse told her, "No, no, you must stay where you are, in Boca Raton." The horse could speak, you see. "But I hate Boca Raton," said the little girl. "The rat's mouth is gross." The horse says, "Let's make a deal. You stay in the rat's mouth during the day with your parents who love you, and at night I promise to take you away. I'll fly you to the moon and back, to every country in the world. I'll get you the hell away from here, as long as you're not so afraid." The girl says, "I'll take that deal." The horse says, "Hold on." 2. My father is taking me to my first baseball game. I am 7 years old and ready for it, with new Keds sneakers, a Hawaiian print fanny pack buckled around my hips, a real grown-up baseball cap. My mother takes our picture before we leave the house. We stand against a palm tree in the front yard, beaming. My father's hand rests on top of my cap. In the car, my father sips from a glass in the center console. He finishes it quick, makes clucking sounds with his lips at the taste. He tries to explain baseball to me. The plates, the diamonds, the way the dirt will spray majestic and red. He waves his hand around with each description, his gold rings glittering, a merit hanging from his lips. I write the steering wheel. Lately, when my parents' voices sound garbled and tired, when their eyes get sticky and small, I call them Sleepy Girl and Sleepy Boy. I open the driver's door of Sleepy Boy's Mercedes and pull him out by the pinky. We walk a funny walk to the big bleachers, wave hello to the people he knows. I am so proud to have Sleepy Boy as my date, to be at a real baseball game with real teams. The mosquitoes curdle black around the stadium lights as I chew, open-mouthed, on a hot dog without the bun. Sleepy Boy screams, growls some, his arms golden and pumping when the right man runs. Two trophies on fire. Our team wins. My father is my father again, awake, standing. He runs down to meet his friends at the bottom of the bleachers, screams, "Wait right there, son," in his rasp. The tin bleachers thunder under me. I watch my father with his friends for a long while. They smack each other on the backs, clap their meaty hands. They down drinks from plastic cups, crush them on their foreheads and beneath their sneakers. From here, they're the size of a postcard. If I sent this postcard to my mother, I would caption it, "Happy Men." I kick my feet up and on the bleachers, press my cheek into the metallic cold. I feel safe here, watching him. When the father knocks on the front door, he's lost his key. The mother asks, "Where is the daughter?" The father asks, "Who?" The daughter is sitting on the bleachers, watching each and every light wink off. The daughter zips and unzips her fanny pack, crunches on the Cheerios kept inside. A woman named Heather finds the daughter in the dark, offers her a ride, pulls up a car. The daughter does not know her way home. 3. I am 4, and it's about time for me to begin school. This means the doctor's office. This means shots. My mother cannot calm me down for days. I know what's coming. The needles, the rubber ball, the snap of a band, the blood. I've seen it in movies. I've heard about it. I know it all before the knowing, and I am inconsolable. My father volunteers to take me to the doctor, gives my mother a break. "Pretend this is fun," he says, "like we're going on a date." In the waiting room, I scratch a blue flower from the wallpaper. I flip through magazines I cannot read. I move colored beads around on a wire, stack the beads, unstack them, click, click. My nose begins to gush because it is always doing that. My father pulls me onto his lap, rips the permanent stash of tissues from his pocket, presses hard into my face. "You know what to do," he says. "Calm down, squeeze the spot. You know it's a nervous thing." "Will life always be this nervous?" I ask beneath the tissues. My head is rocked back, and I stare at the ceiling until my eyes cross. The blood gurgles in my throat. "Yes," my father says, "abso-fucking-lutely." In the doctor's office, a nurse sits me down with a thin sheet of paper. My father rolls two tissues into slug-sized wads, stuffs one into each of my nostrils. The nurse gives me a chalky-looking lollipop, and I begin to kick my legs, cry. She snaps her gloves into the garbage can, closes the door. "Listen," says my father. "When I was in the army, we had to get hundreds and hundreds of shots. Imagine, this is jack shit next to that." I cry harder. Nobody understands my pain. Okay, here's what I did," he says. "I had the docs stand in rows facing one another with their needles, the medicines. I walked down the line in between them, shimmied my shoulders left, right, left, right, left, let them poke me all they wanted as I did this stupid dance." My father does the dance for me. He shimmies his shoulders, pretending to be pricked. He says, "Ow, ow, ow, ow," walking toward me with exaggerated wobbles. When the needles come, I am still laughing. My father and I make the sound effects, the warped faces. The first two needles aren't so bad. But then they begin to pop through my biceps. They hurt. When I stop laughing, my father takes my baby toe and pinches it. "Ouch! Why?" I scream. "Focus," he says. "Move it. Put the hurt somewhere else." 4. Billy Joel is my favorite singer. I'm 11, and my father is driving us to his concert. He's been sleepy boy all night, sipping juice from little cobalt glasses, driving the rumble strip all the way down to Plantation. At the stadium, my father speeds past the parking spaces and pulls up on the sidewalk. He drives right over it, honks his horn at a chain of snowbirds in our way. An attendant in a glow-in-the-dark vest motions for my father to roll down his window. He does. "You can't park here, sir," says the attendant. His face in the sliver of window seems so small compared to my father's. His nose is crooked, his cheeks are pimpled and rosy, and I decide that he is kind. "My daughter, she's retarded," says my father. "I forgot our handy pass, but she can't walk right." My father pats my knee with his hand, looks into his lap with his head shaking. "There's nothing I can do about that, sir," says the kind attendant. "Give her this night," says my father. "Billy's her man." My father palms him a small wad of cash. The attendant looks at me, with his eyes all squinty, as if to check. I smile at him, the metal braces, clamps, rubber lip bumper, turquoise bands connecting my buck teeth to the bottom. I am ugly cute, I know, like a too deep sea creature, but I embrace it. I work it. My father is so handsome that everybody thinks I was adopted, a charity case, a mutt from China or Cuba or Mexico or Samoa. Nobody can be sure. The kind boy closes his eyes for a few seconds. I feel sorry for him. Nobody can ever look at me for long. He says, "Fine, go ahead." Outside the car, my father wraps his arms around me. He whispers, "Limp. You've got to limp. Hang your mouth all dumb." He rubs my shoulders as if I'm cold, like he's protecting me. I do what he says. I want to be a good daughter. I drag my feet across the sparkling sidewalk and tuck my elbows into my waist, I let my tongue roll out of my mouth as I stare up and into the ashy, polluted sky. In the stadium, my father passes out in his seat. His bottom lip gleams wet, and I wipe it for him with the bell sleeve of my shirt. Billy sings about love, and I swear he's singing directly to me. My father wakes up to Piano Man and says, "We have to go. Let's skip the traffic out of here." "But Piano Man is my favorite song in the whole world." We leave anyway. I listen to Billy sing about bread in his jar over the speakers that line the parking lot. In the car, my father begins to cry. Hard, hiccuping sobs. "What's wrong, Daddy?" I rub his back. "The song," he says. "It's just so true." 5. I'm 5, and my father is taking me to see Siegfried and Roy in Las Vegas. I've been practicing my own magic tricks at home with balloons and straws, blowing on my fists, squeezing foamy trick bunnies. Tonight, I wear a big fluffy coat with a Dalmatian pattern on it. My front tooth is loose, and I can't stop tonguing the sharp edges, the dangling thread of flesh. My father is dressed beautifully, a pressed jacket and pants that smell like Big City. He holds my hand as I watch the show, my eyebrows tight and high as the Siberian tigers jump through hoops, appear, and get gone. I decide, I want to marry my father. I want us to go on these dates for as long as I live. When the show ends, we take a walk on the Las Vegas Strip. We walk to the monorail so we can shoot back down to the Luxor. The whole sky coruscates with lights, a real city, like nothing I've seen. "One more thing before we go back," he says. My father swings his arms in a wild, big way. He makes a fruit loop with his mouth, his eyes wide, rimmed white. From behind his back, he pulls out a stuffed tiger, just like Siegfried's. I am so amazed, I scream. I sit on his shoulders for the rest of the walk home. I squeeze the tiger to my chest. I bob and sway with his steps and turns, forget to be afraid. If my mother gave me language, my father gave me magic. 6. I'm 27, and my mother has the flu. "We'll spend the day together," says my father. "I'm bored with your mom in bed. Come over. Let's have a date." I drive to their house in Atlantic Beach, New York. It's Sunday morning, and we watch television in the living room. My father rocks his knobby knees back and forth on the couch, smiling at Charles Osgood, his favorite anchor. He says, "This ought to be good." It's a special on Houdini. On the show, a voiceover explains Houdini's escape methods. A man holds up the straitjackets between his fingers, shows us some of Houdini's old water tanks. The voiceover explains that when Houdini's mother died, he went around debunking mystics and mediums all over the world. "Why'd he do that?" says my father. "Nothing better to do?" "I think he just missed her," I say. "I think he wanted somebody to prove him wrong." "Before I die," he says, "should I give you a code word so you can test it with the mystics?" We decide it might be fuck. "I'll definitely know it's you then," I laugh. After the show, my father and I take a drive. We cruise along the pale beach, and he shows me the Sands Club, where he had his senior prom, where he saw the Ronettes, the Shirelles. "But that was once upon a time," he says, "early days." A few blocks away, he waits in the car with the top down as I pick up his dry cleaning, piled above my eyes, the plastic wrap sticking to my arms. "This is not a very good date," I scream. He drives me to the groomers so we can pick up our dogs. In the car, he talks about love. He likes my new girlfriend, Hannah, warns me not to get too drunk and sloppy at a wedding we will attend. "They don't like lesbos in Mexico," he says, winking. "No tongue kissing." This is the first time he brings up my girlfriend on his own. I squeeze his hand. The conversation circles back to Houdini. "You don't believe in life after death? Not even a little?" I ask. "No," he says. "But I do know this. I'll know when I'm going to die. I'll feel it. The doctors say I'm not doing so hot, but I'll know it. I swear. He pats me on the back. I'll know it, okay? I nod. At home, my father eats a bean stew I slow cooked for him. He says it tastes too healthy, but he'll take the health. The recipe is ancient, Mayan. Legend says that eating a bowl of it every day will make you immortal. You saved me today, he says. You cooked, you cleaned, you kept me company. So good, he says. You're always so good to me. Stay over, he says. Call into work. I need you longer. Please, stay, he says. I tell him I can't. I have a date tonight. I tell him to call me if he feels worse, to call whenever he wants. I promise to come back if he needs me. You know you can call any time. You know that. You fixed for dough? He asks. He hands me a wad of cash. Be good, Kooks. I kiss him on the forehead. I say, I love you, Dad. I say, I'll come by next weekend. This is the last day I ever spend with my father. I am 8, and my mother has decided that enough is enough, that Sundays will now be father-daughter Sundays, and we must have fun, we must have laughs, we must have quality time, no bullshit, no drinking, no drugging, enough. This week, my father has quit drinking again. On Sunday, he drove another man's car home from a bar because the valet gave him the wrong key. The cops surrounded our home at 4 in the morning, and my father answered the door with his fists in the air, naked, screaming, I want to see my car in my driveway before I let you take this one. My father promises my mother that we will have a nice, sober day. He's going to take me to Sam Ash Music Store, he says. Let me bang the snares off the Pearl drum set I want so badly. Then he'll take me to La Bamba, he says, the little Mexican restaurant nearby. We'll share arroz con pollo and cherry cokes. If we have time, we'll even take a drive to the beach. My mother hugs us both goodbye, smiles with watery eyes. She says, I am proud of you, to my father, as if he is her other child. My father keeps his word. He drives me to Sam Ash in the strip mall, pulls up right in front of it. He says, first, can we check out some scores? Then we'll play those toms. Next door to Sam Ash is a sports bar called Gatsby's. It's a horseshoe-shaped bar with fly tape twirling from the ceiling. A jukebox pulsates with rainbow lights in the corner of the room like a giant jellyfish. My father helps me onto a stool at the bar. He sits next to me, gazes up at the football game, lights a smoke. He's placed his bets, he tells me, enough money to pay my college tuition. This is another thing he was supposed to quit. He taps his gold pinky ring against the bar in triplets. A woman named Irene brings my father a glass of orange juice, but I know there's more to it than that. Irene doesn't even need his order. She just says, Hi, boss, I got you, madman. She squeezes my cheeks between her long, sharp nails. What is she, boss? A Oriental? I ask her for a Shirley Temple, please. My father takes down his juice. He makes a sound of relief, the same one he makes sometimes when he takes a leak on the side of the road. A second glass arrives before he even asks for it. You're not supposed to be doing that anymore, I say. Doing what? Says my father. He doesn't look at me. He doesn't shift his eyes from the game. The little men running. The bad stuff, I say. Sleepy boy stuff. It's OJ, says my father. Made of oranges, pulpy, sweet, full of vitamin C. He dips his fingers in his glass, flicks some of the juice in my face. See? I know better. I know we won't make it to the music store or share our chicken and rice. I know we will never walk along the shoreline. We won't bring home shells. My father screams at the television. Irene screams with him. Go, 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 baby, go! I take the half-drunk glass out of his hand and chug the bitter down. It stings my throat, makes my eyes well. I take it down like it's medicine. I cough. My father finally looks at me, forgets the screen. He stabs his merit in the amber ashtray. He says, "What'd you do that for?" shaking me by the shoulders. "Shirley Temple didn't come," I say. "I was thirsty." We look directly into each other's eyes, and I think, for the first time, we understand one another. My face is on fire, but I try to keep my mouth steady, stern. "Let's go," he says, pulling me off the stool by my armpits. At home, he locks himself in the bathroom. He doesn't even watch the rest of the game. I tell my mother he got sick at the restaurant. I tell her it must have been something that we ate. 8. We spend every Memorial Day weekend in the Florida Keys for my father's birthday. I'm 26, and this will be our last year here. Today, on his 68th birthday, my father is depressed. His emphysema is making his body work too hard to breathe, causing his muscles to shrivel. His body is fragile, all bulging bones, rust-colored scabs, bandages. He doesn't want to go fishing this year. He doesn't want to go on his boat. He cannot eat seafood for fear of his feet ballooning into a deep purple gout. He only talks about death and money. He sleeps in the shade all the time, skips meals. He's barely my father anymore. "I'm not strong enough," he says, "to reel in. I'm an old man, but I'm no Santiago." I take him to the swimming pool instead. The two of us dip our legs in the water, sit on the lip of the pool. When I think of my father, I think of my heart breaking in stages. A dull pain, then piercing, electric. Still, somehow, gradual. The way his legs look in the swimming pool today, that's the first stage of my grief. Even the blue bloat of water doesn't make them look any stronger or more capable than a child's. "One thing I'd change," he says, "is that I never did teach my daughter to swim." 9. I am 21, and David and I have broken up for good this time. For real, I promise, swear it, no takebacks. In Vegas, I help my father work the shoe booth in the Mandalay Bay Convention Center. "This'll take your mind off that asshole," he says, but I excuse myself to cry in the convention center bathroom at least once an hour. On the final day of the show, when it closes at 6 p.m., my father hands me a wad of cash. "Go out tonight," he says. "Treat yourself to a date. Give yourself a time." My cousin Tanya rides in the cab with me. "Why do you need a babysitter?" she says. "I just don't want to be alone," I say. "Why has nobody gotten that yet?" I ask the cab driver to take us to the best of the best. The women. He knows what I mean. Tanya smokes a Marlboro out the window, says, "You're crazy, you know." The doormen at the Spearmint Rhino are not used to women. They want to know where our men are, who's paying. The bouncer scoots us into a small room near the entrance. "You sisters? Cousins. Asian act? Cousins. You coming to take our business? You women are always take, 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 take." And I shake my head. I say, "No." I say, "I am here for the women. I am here for the show." "We're sending security near you," he says, "to watch you, because if you solicit our fucking men, if you take them, if you are here for our men, there is going to be a problem. Do you understand?" "We are not here for your men. We are here for the women." A security guard leads us to two seats in the front row. We order vodka and orange juice on the rocks, clank our glasses. Green lights dart across the stage, the walls. "Is this what you want?" asks Tanya. "Because you are so fucking funny, you know? You are so freaking weird. How are we related? You are so fucking funny. This is so gay, you know that?" "Pick one," says Tanya. "Pick a girl. I know you want to." I can't choose. Instead, I pull my father's wad from the pocket of my purse. I lean back in my chair, bend my pointer finger to say, "Come here, come." The women, they grind on my lap and they say, "You're cute, which man are you with?" And I say, "Tell me about you. What's your real name? Who are you?" I want them to tell the truth, but I want to give them a story. "How much?" This much, I say, shaking my father's cash. I make bills disappear in my left hand and reappear in my right. Oh, you got tricks, they say, and I nod. The next morning, my father asks me for change. I gave you more than I'd meant to, he says, all that money. I gave it to the women, I say. Have I taught you nothing? He says. Women, those kinds of women, don't ever look them in the eyes. 10. I am 26, visiting my father in Boca. Tonight, he wants us to join his childhood friends for dinner. We used to party together, he says. Me, your mom, and the couple. They're my wildest friends, the greatest. At dinner, over oysters, the couple asks me about a boyfriend. Is he handsome? Is he Jewish? Is his mother still alive? Does he eat meat? A girlfriend, I say. Hannah. Oh. But you're pretty, says the couple. You've done so much for yourself, so much going your way. I'm in love. That's all I ever did. No children for you then, says the couple. No child should be fatherless. No man will ever love a fatherless girl. She won't know how to treat him right, how to rub a man's feet. In the car ride home, my father apologizes on behalf of the couple, his oldest friends. No friends of mine, he says. Not anymore. Out. Why? I ask. Don't you feel the same about her? If anyone is ever going to make my daughter cry, he says, it ought to be me. 11. I'm 27 when it happens. My mother clasps my father's gold chain necklace around his wrist wrappings, the necklace my grandfather once gave him. The chain feels cold to the touch, heavy, like a fistful of snow. When the doctor removes the tubes from his trach, my mother and I lift the blanket all the way up to his chin, pulling his arms out and over it. With his new shave, no snakes of plastic, he looks honorable, handsome even, like he's been napping all this time. I hold the seashell of his hand, and my brother's mother and I plead with him, "Let go. You're safe." We watch the colors, lips parting indigo, the rush of grays and blues through the square patches of visible skin, red eyelids of a pigeon. And then it happens. It happens as quiet as that. The doctor, a flash in the eye, a nod. That. My brothers clear the room, and I hold my father's body like a child, like he needs me, wrapping his slumped arms around my shoulders. Here and here and here you are. Mine. You were something that was mine. My mother unclasps the necklace. 12. In grief, I try to become my father. My own body is not enough. I am too small for my sadness. I wear my father's striped t-shirts, his socks, even his underwear, rolled up at the yellowed elastic. I scrub my gums with his toothbrush, spit blood. I take shots off his inhaler and wait for the rush of life. I even watch action films, karate movies, explosions, skull splatters in Italian restaurants, and replay the most violent parts. My mother charges his cell phone every night. She uses it to call me sometimes and swears this is a mistake. Whenever his name appears on my screen, I am hopeful. He could be on the other line this time. He could be getting through. Hi, Daddy, I say. I'm sorry, she says, hanging up. Ghosts are better than nothing. Ghosts move. They want things. To haunt each other, then, is a way for my mother and I to keep him. He is more than a voice in the walls, a Ouija board movement, an iridescent cloud in the dark. He can exist here, inside us, through possession. We do our best to play the roles. Our own bodies are not big enough. Falling in love with someone, I think, is at least like that. 13. I'm 17, unpacking in my dorm room in New York City. I've moved here to be closer to my dad. I want to walk his streets, eat his favorite pastrami, try on a new relationship with him. Well, he says, let's start with a movie. 10:30 tomorrow morning? 10:30, I ask, on a Saturday? Better seats this way, he says. Okay, it's a date. My father is 30 minutes early to the movie. I am 10 minutes early, and he tells me I am late. I'm going to teach you two things about life, he says. You better listen, he says. 1. Early is on time. 2. Always be early. We share popcorn, wedge it between our cushions. We watch Little Miss Sunshine. I keep my legs propped up on my seat, bend them until they're numb. People in Florida have told me rats run around the theater floors here, gnawing on your shoelaces, your leftover snacks. My father shakes his legs incessantly, taps his loafers. He chews and clicks his teeth in loud smacks. I tell him to keep it down, and he elbows me, reminds me that there's nobody else in the theater. In the dark, with the light on his face, he looks the happiest he's ever looked. His face is relaxed, his mouth slightly open, in awe. He gives my hand 3 quick squeezes. I walk him home after the movie. Years from now, this is the part I will miss most. It's never about the movies themselves. I don't even remember them. It's about the credits rolling, our eyes adjusting to the world outside, his leather jacket leaning against the ticket booth, the walk. We pick up drooping slices of pizza and let the oil run down our chins as we make our way down 2nd Avenue. Soon, so soon, my father will not be able to use his legs like this. He'll take a car to meet me those few blocks away, and then to go home. But right now, he does. He makes it, and I do too. We make our Saturday morning movie for 9 more years. We are always on time.